I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last month, we got a note from a listener named Pete, who was moved to write after a program we did about National Guard policies and the governor's plan to offer better tuition benefits, among other things. Pete wrote, "I'm wondering if you'd consider doing a program on conscientious objectors and counter-recruitment in Vermont. We often hear from the military, but we seldom hear from folks working for peace in a demilitarized world. I think in order to provide a balanced perspective to Vermonters, it would be nice to hear from the non-military side of things." Vermont does have a strong tradition of pacifism and nonviolent protest, and we're going to look into it a little bit today. I'm joined in the studio by Rachel Siegel, Executive Director for the Peace and Justice Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
And by Dr. John Ruhr, a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's a Quaker and also teaches nonviolent conflict resolution at St. Michael's College in Colchester. Nice to have you on the program today.
Happy to be here.
So, John, could you start us off by talking a little bit about the very longstanding Quaker tradition of peace and pacifism?
Yeah, the Quakers got started in the 17th century with a man named George Fox and friends, and spread as a movement that believed that human beings could connect directly with God, and they didn't have to be told by a priest or a king what to believe. This made them very unpopular in England, and they ended up in the United States, primarily in Pennsylvania, where their principles of believing that God is inherent in every human being forbade the killing of Native Americans. And so they formed the Colony of Pennsylvania, which for four generations of human beings had no forts and no army. The result was it was the safest place in the 13 colonies to live. In 1710, the Tuscarora Indians actually sent a delegation asking if they could move there because they knew it was the only safe place for Indians.
And today, is there a strong presence for the Quakers in Vermont?
There is. There's numerous meetings, all part of what they call the New England Yearly Meeting. The Burlington Friends meeting here is very active in its own worship and in social justice and peace issues.
Some Quakers grow up in the tradition, but many come to it later as adults. What's your story?
My story is I was raised Catholic, which served me very well for a long period of time. But being told the same things over and over again for a lifetime just stopped working as well as it once had. And I learned that, in my opinion, it's maybe better for religious people to ask the right questions about the nature of God and human beings and our world rather than claim to have the answers. And the Quakers are people who ask more questions than give answers, and I find that useful in my life at this time.
Does your spiritual tradition not bleed into exactly, but influence your work as a doctor and your decision to also be part of Physicians for Social Responsibility?
Absolutely. For me, I was just gifted and or cursed with a certain sadness whenever I see suffering that looks to me obviously preventable. And obviously the profession of medicine allowed me to address that. But after 30 years in the emergency room fixing people up for what they do to each other and to themselves, I'm much more interested now in helping us all learn how to be safe without feeling like we have to hurt each other.
Rachel Siegel, how did you come to this work?
I could answer that question so many different ways. I actually started off at summer camp as a kid going to a Quaker summer camp. And my mother had gone to the same summer camp, and my father had gone to a Quaker college. So I grew up with a lot of Quaker traditions around me, although we didn't go to meeting, and I called myself Jewish. So the ideas of social justice were very much imbued in my growing up. I am currently working at the Peace and Justice Center, and we work on looking at the intersectional issues of economic and racial justice, peace, and human rights, and do a lot of work that isn't what I would call pacifism, but is called peace building.
What do you see as the difference between those things?
Well, I don't know academically, but I think that the general perception of pacifism has to do with just a lack of action, you know, just being willing to be steamrolled in a way, that people see it as a weakness, as a non-action, a non-willingness to confront issues. But my understanding of nonviolence is that it's much more than the lack of violence. You know, non-hyphen violence, maybe that's a lack of violence. Nonviolence, one word, to me has to do with a very active power that is actually much stronger than violence. And we've seen it in movements like Gandhi's work and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s work, that active nonviolence takes tremendous skill and training and can be stronger, often is stronger than violence. I mean, I sometimes give people the analogy of children fighting. If anybody grew up with a sibling, they know that you really want to get the last word, that it doesn't matter if you agree or disagree. You want to be the last one, right? And that it actually takes more work to hold back. It takes more work not to throw a punch back if somebody punches you. It takes more strength. That nonviolence is a stronger measure. Even though our culture posits that violence is strength, I'm of the firm belief that nonviolence is strength.
And it's not a willingness to acquiesce to another person's side or another person's point of view necessarily, because, I mean, is the point to come to resolution or to, through nonviolent means, make your point the dominant one? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, we might not find resolution always. I don't believe necessarily in conflict resolution as much as I believe in conflict engagement, specifically nonviolent conflict engagement, and that if we are able to engage with people about our differences, we learn and grow and in some cases become closer and in many cases can come to resolution. But I don't think we always can, especially if you're dealing with people who are positioning themselves in an extreme place where they don't actually even want to come together with other people.
John, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's important to come to a new understanding of the word nonviolence versus violence. And for me, as a conflict resolution specialist, there are simply different ways to wield power. So in a violent use of power, you're basically at some point saying, I can't live with your behavior and I'm going to do something about it. And one of us is going to not get our needs met here, and hopefully it'll be you. Somebody doesn't count in a violent conflict resolution scheme or conflict management or engagement scheme. In nonviolence, you say the same thing. I can't live with your behavior, but we're going to work on this together until it's satisfactory to both of us or we can come to some sort of live and let live. But I can't let you get away with behavior that's unacceptable. And that's the big difference between the word pacifism and what we mean by nonviolent direct action.
So do you fundamentally believe that there is always a place that two parties can come to agreement, can come to resolution?
Not to agreement, like Rachel said, not always to agreement. Some people are just too damaged, too traumatized, too mean, whatever word you want to use. So it's the application of power to create safety for you and defense of your values and the people you love in the face of whatever they're throwing at you, but without becoming what they are. The big weakness of violence is ultimately you become what your enemy is. I mean, that's just the nature of all violence. Look at these school shootings today. I mean, and the answer is more guns. You want teachers with guns, everybody with guns. It's just going to result in more shootings. And it's the same at the opposite end of the spectrum in global affairs. Here we are. We could have gotten rid of nuclear weapons a long time ago, and we are proving once again that they're almost worthless by threatening everybody with ultimate destruction. There are limits to violence. It's time to go to the alternative.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Stratford. Hi, John. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much. I moved to Vermont in 1970 to do 2 years alternative military service as a conscientious objector, and found a number of traditions, historic traditions, that in this regard that I was so unaware of, and I'm probably pretty sure many of your listeners aren't unaware of. The first was Camp William James in Sharon, Vermont. It was an experimental CCC camp that mixed Ivy League students with inner city kids and later became the basis for the Peace Corps. And I was fortunate enough to be mentored by two of the people who served there in the 30s, Robert O'Brien, who later became a sheep farmer and an Orange County senator, and Clint Gardner, who went on to found Bridges for Peace in the 1980s. And it was the premise of the camp from William James was to provide the moral equivalent of war for young people doing community service. It's an important part of Vermont history that I'm afraid most people don't know. Second thing was universalism in Vermont. It was a theology based on love and inclusiveness, and it was primarily in the hill countries of Vermont, New Hampshire, and western Massachusetts, and it took root after the Revolutionary War. In my own town of Stratford, in 1798, the Universalist Society was founded by people who had served in our own community on both sides of the conflict, people who had fought for Burgoyne as loyalists at Saratoga, as well as people who had the revolutionary movement in Stratford. And this theology of universal love was, I think, an important foundation in Vermont. And actually, Universalists became the second denomination after Quakers to oppose slavery.
Well, John, I appreciate you sharing some of Vermont's history and some other ways that nonviolent protest and pacifism have worked in this state. And Rachel, maybe you can share a little bit about what the landscape looks like today, because there are many groups that work in different sort of arenas and in different ways for peace.
There are. There's a lot of groups around the state that people can find out more about. Some of them are Vets for Peace, all the different friends meetings that John mentioned, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Vermont Peace Action. There are peace and justice groups in both the Randolph area and Bennington area. And locally, there's the Peace and Justice Center, which also serves as an umbrella organization for Stop the F-35s and Save Our Skies, which I want to mention because there is this ballot question coming up, and it fits with
what— In Burlington?
Yeah, in Burlington. It fits with what John was saying in terms of Vermont having this rich tradition, in this case, the tradition of town meeting days. And while Burlington doesn't have a town meeting per se, we do have ballot questions that voting residents can get on the ballot. And we do have a question coming, and I think it's really exciting that so many people mobilized. We got thousands of signatures on the petition. The city council wanted to change the wording of the question, even though thousands of people had already weighed in. That did not happen. It is going to be on the ballot as it was originally written.
And what's the question?
The question is, do we want the F-35s to be based here at the what's called the Burlington Airport, which is actually in South Burlington with the flight path directly over Winooski. And what we know about the F-35s is that it puts 6,600 people in harm's way in that their homes, according to the Air Force Environmental Impact Statement, will be unsuitable for residential use. And people think it's too late to make a change, that the deal is done, and it's not. There are examples.
Let me bring in a question that we've gotten on military stuff then while you're talking about this. So Alpha 16, who responds to a lot of our programs, says, it's always a good idea to let others do the fighting and dying to protect your rights and freedoms. You're less likely to get hurt that way. We do have a military. We do have people who are now overseas fighting on behalf of the United States. And so, you know, Alpha 16 says, easy to be a pacifist. You don't have to go do the fighting. You don't have to join the war.
I don't know that they're really over there fighting for our freedom. They're fighting because of politicians who have corporate interests in mind. And there's all sorts of intersecting issues around, you know, racial and economic justice that goes with militarism, that it isn't just about us being safe. And in terms of our Air National Guard here, we wouldn't lose any employment if the F-35s don't come.
Well, that is a matter of debate. Without a mission, there is no
base
into the future.
Well, there has to be a mission,
right?
Because every state has to have an Air National Guard. So it's different than what happened across the lake in Plattsburgh, where they lost their military mission and the guard closed. They have dozens of Air National Guards in New York State. We have one in Vermont, so it cannot close. We would get a different mission. And in fact, the Air Force has said that there are other missions. For example, we could have a cybersecurity mission, which if anyone was listening to NPR this morning, you might have heard the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, talking about the need for increased cybersecurity. Now, I didn't agree with everything he said, but that I can agree with, and we could do that right here, and we would actually have more jobs coming in, whereas with the F-35s, we maintain the same employees, and then there's more employees brought in from out of state who are specialists. We're not actually increasing jobs here.
John Ruhr, I understand you actually wanted to be in the military when you were younger. You wanted to be a fighter pilot, maybe even?
My bedroom was filled with model airplanes of fighters from the Sopwith Camel of World War I through the F-111, the predecessor to the F-35. Yes, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. It was terrific. That didn't work out because of my eyesight, and in retrospect, it was quite the blessing because I've come to understand that the constant threat of war really doesn't make anybody more secure. It just gets ready for the next war.
I also want to weigh in that those who are overseas fighting are not often – they're not always there because that's what they want. It's often they're there because they have no better alternatives for themselves economically.
And even if you do believe that a lot of military strength is absolutely necessary for security, and there's not a whole lot of evidence for that, but if you believe it, you'd still have to admit things are getting totally out of proportion. We have a military budget in this country that is equal to the next 11 or 12 countries combined, and most of them are our allies. So if you look at ours compared to all our enemies combined, it's ridiculous overkill. And you could say, well, that just keeps us safer. It's worth whatever money. I mean, that's fine if Americans are doing well, but many Americans aren't doing well. And we're not really making friends. And as history of military actions through the centuries shows, there's always a new technology coming up that can defeat the old. And I just help think that the F-35 is a 21st century version of a 20th century concept, that somehow these little fighter planes can't defend us against nuclear missiles. They can't defend us against cyber attacks. They can't defend us against terrorism. You know, our biggest threats are 21st century threats. We need to stop spending money on ridiculous old programs that are really only to project the power, I think, and make us feel good about this strength when there's really not much behind it.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking about the peace movement in Vermont and the many groups who push for peace. Joining us today are Rachel Siegel, Executive Director of the Peace and Justice Center, and John Ruhr, a Quaker and member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, who teaches nonviolent conflict resolution at St. Michael's College. And joining us for a few moments now is a very well-known activist and artist in the state, Peter Schumann, the founder of Bread and Puppet Theater in Glover. Peter, it's nice to talk with you today.
Hello.
Hi. So you also have been very adamant, very public, and very creative in your anti-war stance. Why did you choose puppets to deliver the message?
Well, we are warriors. We make papier-mâché wars and nobody gets hurt. And we defeat whatever evil we choose to defeat or we see necessary to defeat in the form of a papier-mâché ensemble of evils that need to be destroyed. So that's our pacifism.
And can you talk a little bit, Peter Schumann, about how you feel that message has passed into people through your artwork and what you've accomplished in spreading the message of peace?
Oh, I wish I knew. I don't. But, I mean, yeah, we are Tataists, meaning the opposite of Tina. That I don't know if you remember, but Mr. Reagan and Ms. Thatcher created that formula when the Soviet Union came down, and then Thatcher ended up with that as her nickname for the rest of her life, Tina, she was called, meaning there's no alternative. And that is a very unfortunate formula. The reality is Tata. There are a thousand alternatives to this warlike behavior of this nation and so many others that are being dragged in by this nation into war behavior. The problems haven't been solved. We have a 6,000-year history of horror. So it's about time that we take account, check it out, and find better ways of solving problems. It's ridiculous to think that a bunch of military hardware will solve a problem. It doesn't.
If you talk about a 6,000-year history of horror, what gives you optimism that you and others can turn that around?
Yeah. Just a meeting of people. We work with approximately 100 mostly young people every summer from all areas of the world, actually, of Vermont and many states of the Union and many other countries. And my optimism is rooted in the fact that these are all activists, that they all come here to check out new forms of activism, and they're all on the same page. They're all agreeing. What we need are these alternatives to the model that exists now, which is disastrous.
Peter,
it can be done.
It can be done? You believe that?
I believe that, yes.
Peter Schumann is the founder of Bread and Puppet Theater in Glover. Peter, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we are talking today about peace. We're talking about activism, nonviolent protest. Patrick is calling in from Westford. Hi, Patrick. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much for having this conversation. I think it's really needed. One thing I'm worried about, though, is what I think for some people is a dogmatic adherence to pacifism and social change. It seems to take sort of a blinkered view of conflict. So, you know, for example, here in Vermont, I'm really glad the Green Mountain Boys took up arms. And historically, almost every instance of success that nonviolence advocates point to actually involved quite a bit of violence. So Gandhi's movement would not have succeeded without the counterbalance of armed self-defense and guerrilla war against British colonial forces. MLK would not have had the access to the halls of power had, you know, the threat of Malcolm X, Black liberation, and urban conflict not been looming over everything else. You know, in the end, what kept Nixon from expanding the Vietnam War was, you know, the American officers being fragged by their own soldiers and the threat of violent unrest at home. So my question to the presenters is, you know, how do you define violence and what actions do you feel is sort of allowed in self-defense? Even, you know, William Lord Garrison called John Brown's raid of Harper's Ferry self-defense.
Patrick, yeah, thanks for the questions. Interesting questions. Rachel Siegel, what do you think?
It's a complicated question, for sure. How do we define violence? Violence, I define as causing harm to other people. And I see that in so many ways that aren't physical. And that's a lot of what we address at the Peace and Justice Center. So I'm not sure that that's going to get at what Patrick was asking. But, you know, there's environmental violence, there's economic violence, there's all sorts of systemic and institutional violence, and we work to address those through the work that we do.
But that's interesting because I think that's part of where Patrick was going, and I don't mean to put words in Patrick's mouth, but part of this idea that the work that you do is directly in opposition to violence that is out in the world. And so in some ways, without the violence there, where is the response, the peaceful response? Yeah. You know, do you need that violence in order to have that nonviolent protest? Isn't it a sort of a nonviolent protest against the violence that is there? Do you need that them both?
No, you don't need them both. If violence were suddenly gone, if people weren't causing harm to one another or to the planet, that would be fine. We wouldn't need to protest that. But as long as we need to protest things, I'm going to do it nonviolently. Martin Luther King has a great quote that says, it's not a question of nonviolence versus violence, it's nonviolence versus non-existence. And while, yes, there have been a lot of very successful nonviolent resistance movements that were also coupled with violent movements, I do believe that we need a diversity of tactics, that some people are doing education, some people are doing legislative, some people are doing litigation, that we need all of that hand in hand. I don't know that we need the violent part. I don't know that anybody has studied that. Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan have studied a lot about how nonviolent civil resistance works. And they have a great book and they have some TED Talks. And they, one of the things that they talk about is, you know, guerrilla warfare doesn't encourage more people to join in. Because first of all, they're hidden, so it's hard to even find them. And second of all, it's deadly, which is very hard to convince somebody to join in to do something where they might get killed. Whereas nonviolent activism, if a couple hundred people take to the streets and you see them out your window walking down the street, and you might join them the next day if they take to the streets again, especially if they are, in fact, confronted with violence and respond nonviolently. So if there are hostile counter-protesters or if there are security forces who are violent and the protesters respond with nonviolence and people see that, then they're more likely to go the next day. If they see the protesters fighting back violently, they're less likely to join. So nonviolent movements can grow faster than violent movements.
John, I see you having thoughts, too, that you want to share.
Yeah, human behavior is such that there's always violence and nonviolence. And if you look even in the midst of the worst wars, 99% of the people around the planet are doing nonviolent things like feeding their families and feeding the soldiers and that. It's a long discussion to talk about. Even the history, I can make a very strong argument that the Revolutionary War is not what won us the American freedom from the Brits at all. It was the 10 years of nonviolent resistance before that, epitomized by the Tea Party and a thousand other things, that really won the freedom, and that the war was just to consolidate power. That's a long discussion. I think the important point is to compare the two. In this book by Maria Stefan and Erica Chenoweth that Rachel referenced, and I just met with Maria, she's at the Institute for Peace now, it's very clear that if you mix tactics of violence and nonviolence in a particular campaign, you're less likely to succeed.
No one's
ever studied whether violence or nonviolence is better until their book. And they examined 300 cases of conflict around the world over 106 years. And data is unequivocal. If you use primarily
nonviolence.
And she went into
it. Erica says she went into it expecting to find the opposite result. She was not looking to create these results.
She was a political scientist studying terrorism and the response to terrorism, was shocked by the results. So that's what's exciting to me about peace now, is that it's no longer just a spiritual thing that holy people that have to withdraw and have a special relationship with God can do nonviolent things that the rest of us can't. We want the U.S. Marines and our nuclear weapons. It's really a matter of what works or doesn't. Nuclear weapons have gotten us to the point where how are we happy sitting here thinking our security is totally based on the option for the end of the world? If some crazy Soviet submarine commander or Putin himself or somebody decides a submarine off the New England coast can incinerate us all in the next 15 minutes, how do we think that that, which is the ultimate expression of our belief in violence, is a good, safe, or healthy thing?
On that, let's go to Bob calling in from Rutland City. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. Oh, yes. Thank you for this conversation. I just wanted to follow up with Mr. Ruhr. I was going in the area of the insane nuclear proliferation of which our country seems to be headed for again these days. I wonder if you might address the recent advancement, unfortunately, of the doomsday clock.
I was actually at the advancement of the doomsday clock at the National Press Club in January with some friends from Physicians for Social Responsibility. And what that is about is that the people that know most about nuclear weapons and have been looking at this day in and day out since 1947 make yearly assessments of what they think the risk that the civilization is going to end itself through nuclear weapons, and they have a component of climate change in there also, and decided that this was equal to the most dangerous time in all of the nuclear history, that we're more at risk because you have this double whammy where not only are we building weapons now, we've just agreed to spend another $1.25 trillion over the next 30 years modernizing them, which interpreted means make them more usable. And at the same time, we've got leaders screaming at each other and threatening to use these things against each other. And that double whammy is a very dangerous combination. And the people that know the most about it think we're in real trouble.
Hmm. And I think it's important to note, because it's so overwhelming hearing those statistics and those facts and that sentiment, and it can feel too big to tackle. But in fact, there have been other weapons that seem too big to tackle, namely chemical warfare and landmines, that have been abolished worldwide. And we can do that with nuclear weapons. It might feel like there's no way that that could ever happen in our lifetime, but that's what people thought about landmines and about chemical warfare, and they have been abolished. So we can abolish nuclear weapons. And for people who want to get more involved, there is a film series of movies about nuclear weapons and nuclear war happening in the Burlington area. They can find out more about that at our website, pjcvt.org. And there's also a World Beyond War, What Will It Take? Conference coming up on May 12th, and people can join us.
And John, there are other actions that people are taking. You mentioned that in response to not necessarily signing up for military service, but other ways to serve your country.
Yeah. For example, this concept that only the military can keep us safe overseas. I teach a course that shows the power of nonviolent action. And your title mentioned nonviolent protest. Protest is one of hundreds and hundreds of really powerful nonviolent actions people can take. And maybe the weakest. And that's the one most people think of. So when I teach a whole course on this, or and sometimes just give a 90-minute lecture on it, I'll ask my students, if I paid your college education and gave you an interesting job for 4 years, but you had to go unarmed into a conflict zone, would you do it? Most of the students raise their hands. And I say, well, that's the deal the ROTC guys get. And I'm always talking about, if we can pay people to do violence, let's pay people to do nonviolence and look at the results, see what works.
Well, I appreciate both of you having this conversation with us today. Certainly more to talk about, and I appreciate that you're grappling with these and bringing them onto the show. Rachel Siegel is Executive Director of the Peace and Justice Center. Dr. John Ruhr is a Quaker and member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nate.